In a moment or two, Secretary of State Edward R. Stettinius, Jr. will present to the delegates Harry S. Truman, President of the United States, whose address will be the closing chapter of this, the San Francisco Conference. At the moment, the delegates are being addressed by the chairman of the delegation of the Union of South Africa, Field Marshal Jan Christian Smuts. Today, looking down on the floor of the conference, in appearance, it's much as it was on opening day or the opening session some 9 weeks ago. All the delegates are present. They're in their seats. The plenary session this afternoon, the final one of the conference, was called to order promptly at 3:30 this afternoon Pacific War time, and we have been addressed thus far by 9 delegate chieftains. All the delegates are in their seats. The galleries are crowded, and as many of us here at the conference are so well aware, the excitement which marked the opening days of the parley soon gave way to those weeks in which the conference was characterized more by just plain, hard, and unspectacular work. But now that the charter is written and it's finished, and the delegates are prepared to take it back to their respective capitals for ratification, the presence of Mr. Truman here this afternoon is lending to this final session the proper air of importance and prestige. Speaking of the opening sessions of this conference during the week of April 23rd, looking back to many of us, that seems like a very long time ago. You recall, perhaps, that when Mr. Stettinius called the first plenary session to order on that opening day, the German armies were still intact and the European phase of the war was still very real. Then the first few sessions of this conference, by circumstance certainly which no one regretted, were forced to compete with the greatest news stories and headlines of all history, perhaps. The German armies began to surrender. The big push broke through in Italy. Mussolini, you recall, was captured by Italian patriots. The Red Army went on to ultimately enter Berlin. And then finally came the series of surrenders which marked the final fall of Germany. And with so much history packed into such a brief period of time, thus the opening of this conference indeed seems like a very long time ago. I dare say that feeling is harbored also by many of the delegates here and their advisors and counselors. The work of this conference has been tremendous. The hours have been long and tedious. As a matter of fact, a phase of this conference, which has been rather sadly neglected, is that featuring the advisors and the technicians. The lights in their offices and hotel rooms have burned long and consistently as they poured through the tomes of international law and word by word fitted this charter together. Nor does the background work end there, either. Since before the war, all over this nation and throughout other nations, groups of the best minds of the nations have been working together on this question of international organization for peace and security. There have been international and national and regional and small community clubs and organizations and societies, all thinking and planning on this very thing that has occurred here in San Francisco. In this country, in Britain, in Russia, and other nations, a word of appreciation is due perhaps the colleges and universities who have loaned their best scholars and instructors to various agencies of the governments for this very purpose. The result is that the United Nations Charter, which is being signed today by 50 nations and soon to be submitted for ratification of the respective governments, is a grassroots sort of thing. It percolates way down to the people in metropolitan clubs, in country schoolhouses, and in village meetings. Last night, for instance, when Ambassador Halifax, who was chairman of that particular plenary session, rapped his gavel and announced that the charter had been officially accepted, a tremendous cheer went up in this building from both delegates and spectators. But in behalf of the men and women who have labored here to write this document, it's only fair to again repeat their paramount and most persistent request, which is that the people come to know this document, study it, understand it, and debate it. For the United Nations delegates here have said over and over that the success of the New World Organization depends squarely on the extent to which the people will use it and understand it and come to know it. And there, ladies and gentlemen, is the applause indicating the conclusion of the address by Jan Christian Smuts, chief of the delegation from South Africa. And now, Secretary of State Stettinius is about to speak.
Fellow delegates, the President of the United States of America.
Mr. Chairman, and delegates to the United Nations Conference on International Organization. Oh, what a great day this can be in history. I deeply regret that the press of circumstances, when this conference opened, made it impossible for me to be here to greet you in person. I have asked for the privilege of coming today to express on behalf of the people of the United States our thanks for what you have done here and to wish you Godspeed on your journeys home. Somewhere in this broad country, every one of you can find some of our citizens who are sons and daughters or descendants in some degree of your own native land. All our people are glad and proud that this historic meeting and its accomplishments have taken place in our country. And that includes the millions of loyal and patriotic Americans who stem from the countries not represented at this conference. We are grateful for your coming. We hope you have enjoyed your stay and that you will come again. You assembled in San Francisco almost 9 weeks ago with a high hope and confidence of peace-loving people the world over. Their confidence in you has been justified. The hope, their hope for your success has been fulfilled. The Charter of the United Nations, which you are now signing, is a solid structure upon which we can build for a better world. History will honor you for it. Between the victory in Europe and the final victory in Japan, in this most destructive of all wars, you have won a victory against war itself. It was the hope of such a charter that helped sustain the courage of stricken peoples through the darkest days of the war. For it is a declaration of great faith by the nations of the earth, faith that war is not inevitable, faith that peace can be maintained. If we had had this charter a few years ago, and above all, the will to use it, millions now dead would be alive. If we should falter in the future in our will to use it, millions now living will surely die. It has already been said by many that this is only a first step to lasting peace. That is true. The important thing is that all our thinking and all our actions be based on the realization that it is in fact only a first step. Let us all have it firmly in mind that we start today from a good beginning, and with our eye always on the final objective, let us march forward. The Constitution of my own country came from a convention which, like this one, was made up of delegates with many different views. Like this charter, our Constitution came from a free and sometimes bitter exchange of conflicting opinions. When it was adopted, no one regarded it as a perfect document. But it grew and developed and expanded. And upon it, there was built a bigger, a better, and a more perfect union. This charter, like our own Constitution, will be expanded and improved as time goes on. No one claims that it is now a final or a perfect instrument. It has not been poured into a fixed mold. Changing world conditions will require readjustment, but they will be the readjustments of peace and not of war. That we now have this charter at all is a great wonder. It is also a cause for profound thanksgiving to Almighty God, who has brought us so far in our search for peace through world organizations. There were many who doubted that agreement could ever be reached by these 50 countries differing so much in race and religion, in language and culture. But these differences were all forgotten in one unshakable unity of determination to find a way to end wars. Out of all the arguments and disputes and different points of view, a way was found to agree. Here in the spotlight of full publicity, in the tradition of liberty-loving people, opinions were expressed openly and freely. The faith and hope of 50 peaceful nations were laid before this world forum. Differences were overcome. This charter was not the work of any single nation or group of nations, large or small. It was the result of a spirit of give and take, of tolerance for the views and interests of others. It was proof that nations like men can state their differences, can face them, and then can find common ground on which to stand. That is the essence of democracy. That is the essence of keeping the peace in the future. By your agreement, the way was shown toward future agreements in the years to come. This conference owes its success largely to the fact that you have kept your minds firmly on the main objective. You had the single job of writing a constitution, a charter for peace, and you stayed on that job. In spite of the many differences and distractions which came to you in the form of daily problems and disputes about such matters as new boundaries, control of Germany, peace settlement, reparations, war criminals, the form of government of some of the European countries, in spite of all these, you continued in the task of framing this document. Those problems and scores of others which will arise are all difficult. They are complicated. They are controversial and dangerous. But with the united spirit, we met and solved even the more difficult problems during the war. And with the same spirit, if we keep to our principles and never forsake our objectives, the problems we now face and those to come will also be solved. We have tested the principle of cooperation in this war and have found that it works. through the pooling of resources, through joint and combined military command, through constant staff meetings, we have shown what united strength can do in war. That united strength forced Germany to surrender. United strength will force Japan to surrender also. The United Nations have also had experience, even while the fighting was still going on, in reaching economic agreements for times of peace. What was done on the subject of relief at Atlantic City, food at Hot Springs, finance at Bretton Woods, aviation at Chicago, was a fair test of what can be done by nations determined to live cooperatively in a world where they cannot live peacefully any other way. What you have accomplished in San Francisco shows how well these lessons of military and economic cooperation have been learned. You have created a great instrument for peace and security and human progress in the world. The world must now use it. If we fail to use it, we shall betray all those who have died in order that we might meet here in freedom and safety to create it. If we seek to use it selfishly, for the advantage of any one nation or any small group of nations, we shall be equally guilty of that betrayal. The successful use of this instrument will require the united will and firm determination of the free peoples who have created it. The job will tax the moral strength and fiber of us all. We all have to recognize, no matter how great our strength, that we must deny ourselves the license to do always as we please. No one nation, no regional group can or should expect any special privilege which harms any other nation. If any nation would keep security for itself, it must be ready and willing to share security with all. That is the price which each nation will have to pay for world peace. Unless we are all willing to pay that price, no organization for world peace can accomplish its purpose. And what a reasonable price that is. Out of this conflict have come powerful military nations, now fully trained and equipped for war. But they have no right to dominate the world. It is rather the duty of these powerful nations to assume the responsibility for leadership toward world peace. That is why we have here resolved that power and strength shall be used not to wage war, but to keep the world at peace and free from the fear of war. By their own example, the strong nations of the world should lead the way to international justice. That principle of justice is the foundation stone of this charter. That principle is the guiding spirit by which it must be carried out. Not by words alone, but by continued concrete acts of goodwill. Now, there is a time for making plans, and there is a time for action. The time for action is here now. Let us, therefore, each in his own nation and according to its own way, seek immediate approval of this charter and make it a living thing. I shall send this charter to the United States Senate at once. I am sure that the overwhelming sentiment of the people of my country and of their representatives in the Senate is in favor of immediate ratification. A just and lasting peace cannot be attained by a diplomatic agreement alone or by military cooperation alone. Experience has shown how deeply the seeds of war are planted by economic rivalry and by social injustice. The Charter recognizes this fact, for it has provided for economic and social cooperation as well. It has provided for this cooperation as a part of the very heart of the entire compact. It has set up machinery of international cooperation, which men and nations of goodwill can use to help correct the economic and social causes for conflict. Artificial and uneconomic trade barriers should be removed to the end that the standard of living of as many people as possible throughout the world may be raised. For freedom from want is one of the basic four freedoms toward which we all strive. The large and powerful nations of the world must assume leadership in this economic field as well as in all others. Under this document, we have good reason to expect an international bill of rights acceptable to all the nations involved. That Bill of Rights will be as much a part of the international life as our own Bill of Rights is a part of our Constitution. The Charter is dedicated to the achievement and observance of human rights and fundamental freedoms. Unless we can obtain those objectives, all men and women everywhere, without regard to race, language, or religion, we cannot have permanent peace and security in the world. With this charter, the world can begin to look forward to the time when all worthy human beings may be permitted to live decently as free people. The world has learned again that nations, like individuals, must know the truth if they would be free. Must read and hear the truth, learn and teach the truth. We must set up an effective agency for constant and thorough interchange of thought and ideas. For there lies the road to a better and more tolerant understanding among nations and among peoples. All fascism did not die with Mussolini. Hitler is finished, but the seed spread by his disordered mind have firm root in too many fanatical brains. It is easier to remove tyrants and destroy concentration camps than it is to kill the ideas which gave them birth and strength. Victory on the battlefield was essential, but it was not enough. For a good peace, a lasting peace, the decent peoples of the earth must remain determined to strike down the evil spirit which has hung over the world for the last decade. The forces of reaction and tyranny all over the world will try to keep the United Nations from remaining united. Even while the military machine of the Axis was being destroyed in Europe, even down to its very end, they tried to divide us. They failed, but they will try again. They're trying even now. To divide and conquer was and still is their plan. They still try to make one ally suspect the other, hate the other, desert the other. But I know I speak for every one of you when I say that the United Nations will remain united. They will not be divided by propaganda either before the Japanese surrender or after. This occasion shows again the continuity of history. By this charter, you have given reality to the ideal of that great statesman of a generation ago, Woodrow Wilson. By this charter, you have moved toward the goal for which that gallant leader in this second world struggle worked and fought and gave his life, Franklin D. Roosevelt. By this charter, you have realized the objectives of many men of vision in your own countries who have devoted their lives to the cause of World Organization for Peace. Upon all of us, in all our countries, is now laid the duty of transforming into action these words which you have written. Upon our decisive action rests the hope of those who have fallen, those now living, and those yet unborn, the hope for a world of free countries with decent standards of living, which will work and cooperate in a friendly, civilized community of nations. This new structure of peace is rising upon strong foundations. Let us not fail to grasp this supreme chance to establish a worldwide rule of reason, to create an enduring peace under the guidance of God.
You get the copy for Sauter.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have just heard the President of the United States addressing the delegates at this, the concluding plenary session of the United Nations Conference for International Organization. Now, in just a moment, Secretary of State Stettinius will address the microphones once more.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Preparatory Commission will meet at 11 o'clock tomorrow morning in room 230, 223 of the Veterans Building. And I now hereby declare the United Nations Conference on International Organization adjourned.
Broadcast came to you from the War Memorial Opera House in San Francisco as a feature of CBS World News.
Big Town, usually presented at this time over most of these stations by the makers of ironized yeast, was not heard tonight. Listen next Tuesday evening at its regularly scheduled time for Big Town. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.